It's time now for our ongoing series discussing substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium.
This morning, we're going to continue our interview. We have Sherry Reeves and Raymond Jones. Now, one of the things that people sometimes do that they don't realize they're doing is enabling somebody to just go down the path that they wish they wouldn't go down, but then they enable them. So what are some forms of enabling that people don't realize is enabling?
People that are addicted, that have substance use disorder, are very savvy when it comes to getting what they need to get their next fixed. We have that distinction of being pretty good at getting what we want. So thinking when you're shaming a family member into giving you $20, I need it for diapers for my kid. The person that's enabling the addict, is giving them cash is enabling. That's a bad idea, always. If you need to, let's go get some diapers at the store, but I'm not giving you cash. Enabling is helping somebody to further their disease because it makes that person feel better in the moment. It's not actually helping the person that's got the substance use disorder. I'll feel better about myself. I know this person won't have to sleep on the street tonight if I let him stay here, even though I'm going to wake up tomorrow and all my wedding, my jewelry's going to be gone. Mm-hmm. At least I feel better because they're not dead. That's enabling. When it's not helping the person out of their darkness, it's enabling. And that, when you're assisting somebody, you're helping them, you're giving them the resources, you're giving them options. It's still up to them whether to take them or not. But you've got a hard line that you're keeping. I'm not going to let you come over to our house for dinner until you've done this. You set a line and it's for the other person, not for you. There's a difference there. And people don't seem to see that. I hear a lot of times all these enablers, like talking about when it was with the needle exchange, you're enabling. And it's like, could you look that up in the dictionary and get back to me on what, because it's not enabling when it's helping somebody out of their addiction. And maybe it's not instant. Just because it didn't work today doesn't mean it's not in their head. I remember so many times now while I was in my addiction where people actually intervened on me and I had no idea that's what was going on then. All the little things that were said or done over time, the court stepping in and taking my kids for a minute, then leaving them with my parents, that I did not see that as a good thing when it happened. I saw that as them, infringing upon my life and my choices. And it wasn't. It was a wake up call. And it didn't work immediately, but it did eventually. So
how long did it take before you realized what was going on in your mind? Because you're saying, I don't have this problem, I don't have that problem. When did it finally go boing? I've really goofed up here, and I'm going to go this other direction that they're asking me to take.
When my kids were removed from my care, that was in 1995, and I did not get clean until 2001.
Whoa.
And I was working at the Westport Shipyard, and I had fallen 6 weeks prior. I had been up for weeks, and I was not in my right state of mind.
So what, you were taking meth then?
I was.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and I was to the point at that time I had binged. I would do about 6 month binges was my deal, and then I would get clean for a little bit, get quote unquote clean. I would drink or do something else besides meth. To me that was clean. I didn't know any better. And I was basically told to get clean or get gone by my employer because I was running power equipment while I was loaded. I mean, it really bad, mm-hmm. bad things. My kids were getting ready to be taken away again. My parents were getting ready to file for permanent custody. I don't know why when it was presented to me that I either get clean and I could still have a job, or I would basically be considered a walk-off. I wasn't going to get unemployment, so I couldn't use until I died, which was my other option. They were both equally sucky options to me. I said, I think I'll try recovery. And it was, it was an epiphany. I mean, I started bawling. The HR director kind of pushed his chair back and he's like, I think I broke her because I was just bawling. I was running around Westport telling everybody. They were like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, going to rehab. They're like, thank God. It's like everybody knew. And I knew that. And when I finally accepted that I was the last to know I was addicted, that's when the real change started to happen. But I was faced with losing my job. I had already lost my place to live. I was staying at a motel with my kids, two of my kids. And I had pretty much lost everything else. It was like there were options. I had other options, but none of them I was done. I was just done. I think we reach that multiple times in our addiction. We reach that done phase. And what's really hard is when somebody's actually done, but there's no out for them at that time. It takes so long to get someone into treatment or to get, any kind of resources set up. It's hard.
So you can hit rock bottom, but unless there's somebody to pull you out, then that initiative, I want to do something about it, goes away because you can't find somebody to pull you out of it?
It can. It can. Okay. People that I see a lot of times when people are in jail, it actually gets stronger. At first they go in and they're like, well, I'll do anything to get out of jail. And then they start actually, they talk that so much that they start actually believing it. And then if they're fed, you know, like encouragement to that end, and they start doing a little bit of their own research, I find out a lot of times that people, they didn't know that they were done until they were removed from their drug of choice for a certain amount of time. It's uncomfortable in jail.
Okay.
They decide they don't want to go back anymore. And they just are, you know, and everybody's rock bottom is different. And
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Because I was going to ask
there's multiple.
Ray about his rock bottom.
Yeah,
everybody's rock bottom is different is exactly right. Because I thought I hit rock bottom in 1974. After I got out of the military, and I thought, this is it. I am done. I'm never going to do this again. I can't stand it. I'm losing everything in my life. This makes no sense. All these things came up. You know, what am I doing? I went to a 12-step program. I thought, man, this is it. You know, I'm going to get committed. But I didn't get actually clean and sober until 1989. So from 1974 to 1989, I had a lot of rock bottoms. I didn't go to treatment. I never went to treatment. But I did go to a lot of 12-step programs. And I went to AA most of the time. I also went to Al-Anon. And both of them were very helpful. I would get, like Sherry said, I would get clean and sober, you know. I thought I was clean and sober. Hey, I'm clean and sober, you know. I've been clean and sober for 6 months. I got this thing nailed. Somebody'd say something, bam, the trigger would come on, and somehow, don't know how it happened, I was back in drinking again, you know. And how did this happen? Mm-hmm. And then we'd have to start all over again. And that starting all over again sometimes took 2 years. One mistake, and then 2 years later, I finally got it together again to try it one more time, to try to get straight and clean and sober. That went on for 15 years. And finally, there was some rock bottom that hit. I can't even really explain what that rock bottom was. I just know that I woke up from being unconscious, basically, from falling out of my car at nighttime. When I got up to go in the house, I just fell backwards and ended up on the ground upside down. and I woke up, you know, at some point after that with this guy screaming at me. And that was the time, that was the place to change.
So that was a DUI then?
It wasn't a DUI. Oh, okay. No, I was one of those people, never got a DUI. I should have. Oh, man, I should have. I never got in, never went to jail. And, you know, I knew a lot of people that were way less alcoholic and way less driving impaired than I was, and yet that never happened to me. And it might have been a good thing had that happened to me, because maybe it would have started that rock bottom a lot sooner. But when I finally hit that one spot that I can't even really totally explain to you, something changed, and I thought, I've got to do this or I'm going to die. Because addiction is a deadly disease, and you're either gonna survive and change, or it's gonna take you and you're gonna die from it.
You know what's real interesting? I saw that it was the Washington State Patrol that put this on, and they took people, and then they had them, you know, drink a little alcohol, run some tests, drink a little alcohol, read some poetry, drink a little alcohol, and one of the people that was in this, and I think there were four people. The more he drank, the easier it was for him to read the poetry, to do all of these things. And finally, the state patrol officer said, "You are the most dangerous person on this stage." Mm-hmm. Because he literally, they were giving him tongue twisters and he just blew through it. And I thought, wow. Whoa, you know, but I think we've all met people that seem to drink and it doesn't seem to do anything to them, but it must do something. And what is that? What have you seen when you have people that have this gargantuan appetite for alcohol and it seems like there nothing's going on, but there has to be. So how do you get those people off the booze?
Well, generally they end up someplace where, in our situation, we treat them after they've had some major problem, okay. And usually they're being forced to come to a treatment program. I mean, the people that I've worked with in treatment over the years have been people that have all been maybe in some way forced. The last program I worked with, we had people that had been in treatment programs probably 15 times before and failed every time, but they got into our program and we finally got to them. It was a very unique program, but it was one of keeping people completely aware of what they're doing, making sure they're completely accountable at all times, and immediately changing, immediately addressing the issue as soon as it happened. And very few programs are like that where they can even do that. So
this is when they're out of the actual security of the rehab. You have people that are kind of keeping an eye on them. How does that work when you know they've strayed or about to stray?
Well, different programs are different, so it's hard to explain that. Different type of rehab programs do it in different ways. I know the program I worked with the probation department and the sheriff's department, and we were in a consortium, as it were, in Klamath Falls, Oregon, and it was called the consortium. And what we did was, if a person came to our program in the evening in an outpatient program and came inebriated, for example, because they blew. They did a UA every mm-hmm. time. If they came inebriated, we immediately called the probation officer who was upstairs.
Oh.
And he came down and said, put your hands behind your back, and he walked them to the jail, which was right next door. That had what we called the splatter effect on other people.
I guess.
Yeah. And it really worked. Our program was an amazing program that worked off what they call the Powder River Project. And I don't know if the Powder River Project still works that way. I don't think it does. And I don't know if the consortium still does that. That was a long time ago. We had an amazing program. But most programs don't have that level of accountability where we can have that kind of wonderful thing where you know, the PO is right upstairs, jail's right next door. So a lot of programs try to that are trying to do outpatient have a hard time with that. We also used, in another program, we used a lie detector test. Now, lie detector tests are not considered adequate in court, but we could use them with the probation officer's mm-hmm. permission, and so we could hold people accountable that way.
Now, was your main addiction alcohol and you didn't do other drugs?
My main addiction was alcohol.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I did marijuana, but honestly,
it wasn't the same effect.
Right. From talking, I mean, when you're talking to an addict, to say, well, it wasn't the same. I mean, if I wasn't using alcohol, I was using marijuana, but I don't consider myself addicted in that same way to marijuana. However, I don't do marijuana anymore because marijuana gets me too close and it can be a trigger for me. Even the smell of marijuana can trigger me to want to drink.
Yeah, kind of loosen up a little bit when you shouldn't.
Right.
Now, Sherry, did you do much alcohol as well?
Or, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So,
I started with alcohol in high school. I was about 17 years old. And I basically started off as a blackout drunk. I did not have a filter that told me, you're feeling good, you need to stop now. I would drink until I blacked out, just assuming that everybody did that. I didn't like the taste of alcohol. I was doing it because everybody was doing it. Basically, it wasn't really peer pressure. It was just a desire to be involved, mm-hmm. you know, to be a part of. And so that's what I did. And starting off with Thunderbird, with red Solo cup full of Thunderbird mixed with lemonade, Kool-Aid, or whatever we put in there, cherry or whatever flavor. It was nasty. And so I drank it fast.
Where was it?
You know?
Oh, yeah,
and
like Mad Dog.
Yeah, like Mad Dog,
yeah.
Things like that. You know, we didn't start with Boone's Hill or anything. No, straight to the Thunderbird. You know, we did that too. But I just never had the opportunity. I never gave myself the opportunity to understand the substance I was putting in my body. I was young. That's why kids should not drink. You know, we don't have that brain functioning. It's not functioning enough at that age to tell us, you know, okay, well, that's a bad idea. You should probably never do that again. Most of us. I know a few people that it did work in high school, but they were much smarter than I. But yeah, I started off with alcohol, and that's any time I was quote unquote clean from my drug of choice, I was drinking. I was never clean for any period mm-hmm. of time. It was always replacing one for another. And alcohol, because there is so much less stigmatizing than what I was using, I would go to alcohol because
Now, did you get the similar effect of it? Of course, I methamphetamine and alcohol are so different from each other.
They are, but they do. They both have the ability to basically. They let me check out,
okay.
And I was euphoric, and I felt like I could conquer the world with either one of those two. I would much prefer the feeling that I got from methamphetamine, but the fallout was a lot more. With alcohol, it was you're up for a little while, then you crash, and you feel like crap for a day, and you swear you're never going to do it again, but the next day you're fine.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like a little, you know, it was kind of a shortened, condensed version of what I had been doing. So I felt like it was a better option at the time, I guess. I don't know.
One of the things that I wanted to bring up, too, when it comes to, we're talking about a stigma here and how people stigmatize people with substance use disorder. There are some genetic factors also involved. We have alleles, which are parts of our chromosomes, little pieces of our chromosomes, so to speak. And they have discovered that people with the A1 allele tend to be very easily prone to becoming substance use disordered. And there are populations that have that great population or a great amount of people with that A1 or A2 allele that causes this problem. So there are chromosomal changes. There are DNA things that happen. There are things that we know now that we didn't know 30 years ago that tell us there are people with a predisposition to being substance use disordered. So that's part of that. That's part of that disease that we never considered years ago. There's also the fact that as children, for example, as Sherry talks, she talks as a when she was a kid, children's brains are still growing. And they said years ago when I used to teach it was called a DAPE program, Drug Abuse Prevention Education, to the first through sixth graders, there was a research that had been done at that time, and that came out about 1 million, that doesn't sound like much when you think of our brains, trillions of cells, but 1 million cells to a child. Each time a child with a growing brain drinks an ounce of alcohol or a jigger full of alcohol, it kills 1 million brain cells. Well, now, if you consider that the child started doing that at age 12 and they're drinking from then on,
right,
that's exponential in the amount of brain cells that it's killing off. There's things going on there that we didn't consider a few years ago.
I really appreciate both of you taking time out to tell your story and also let people know that there's a way to get out of this situation if you go to the right people to do it. And obviously what you do is get people back being the humans they were meant to be and not under the influence of drugs or alcohol. So thank you very much. If you just tuned in, we've had Raymond Jones and Sherry Reeves with us from Community Integrated Health Services.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Join us next Monday morning at 8:40 a.m. for our continuing discussion on substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium, exclusively on 103.5 FM and 1450 a.m. KBKW. To hear archived discussions, log on to gograysharbor.com.